Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kelly, your host. Jimmy Agin's with us both hours today. And it's Ask Me Anything. And I guess you could tell because, well, if you could see what I see, there's only one line open. We're 4 seconds into the show and there's only one line open. So I'll tell you what, I'll give you the number if you want that line, 888-318-7884. It's a narrow set of categories when Jimmy's here. It's anything. You could talk about anything. 888-318-7884. If you can narrow it down to anything, you are welcome. Actually, you know, if it's sports ball, Jimmy's not so big on the sports ball. But anything else, 888-318-7884. If you're a Catholic person, you got questions about your Catholic faith, you're welcome. If you're not a Catholic and you've got questions about the Catholic faith, you're welcome. And if you're any kind of human and you just got a question you want to ask Jimmy Akin, you're also welcome. 888-318-7884. Jimmy is the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, an exciting and sometimes spooky, sometimes just fascinating corner of the podcasting and internet world. You can find it at mysterious.fm. You can find it at Jimmy's YouTube spot, or you can just type in Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World and your computer will find it for you. Jimmy's also a senior apologist here, author of a whole bunch of books, and probably the most likely person for us to call if somebody cancels on this show, because he almost always says yes to us. Hey, Jimmy.
Hey, how's it going, Cy?
Really good. Really very, very good. Today is Thursday, so I can ask what's dropping tomorrow on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World.
It's going to be part two of our look at the Vatican's new norms for discerning supernatural apparitions and other supernatural events. Last week, we covered the prefatory letter that Cardinal Fernandez had in the document, and this time we're going to be looking at the norms themselves and giving examples. Also, as a special bonus feature for this episode, I was looking at the video, and if you watch the video version, you're going to see a lot of my sister's dog.
Oh.
Because I was dog-sitting when we recorded it, and in this episode, she's in the background playing and, you know, with toys and stuff. She's shaking them around, you know, because she's a fierce little dog, and at one point, she, like, comes up to me and stands up on the side of the chair and like puts her arms up on me to get my attention and stuff like that.
No, a guest star. You've got a guest star featuring. Yeah. She should get a featuring credit on there. Again, 888-318-7884, the number. The lines do stay full when Jimmy is our guest, but if you keep working it, you could probably get through and get your question asked and answered. We'll start today with Manny in Sacramento, California, watching on YouTube. Manny, welcome. Go ahead and start us off with your question for Jimmy Akin.
Thank you very much. My question is, how can we respond to Mormons, and I suppose Oneness Pentecostals use this also? They say Ephesians 4:11 and 1 Corinthians 12:28 tell us that one of the marks of the true church is that it must have modern-day apostles. So how can we respond?
Well, in the first place, it doesn't say that the true church must have apostles. The true church did have apostles in the first century, but there's nothing in these verses that say that's going to always be the case. In fact, there is evidence against this in the case of, given the fact that St. Paul indicates one of the criteria for being an apostle. And this is different than being one of the 12. For the 12, there were additional requirements. But one of the requirements for being an apostle is having seen the Lord. You know, at one point he says, am I not an apostle? Have I not seen the Lord? And he's referring to his commissioning by Jesus back in Acts chapter 9. So with one of the criteria being you have to have seen the Lord, well, if the church is going to exist past the apostolic age, then you're not going to have more folks who have seen the Lord unless Jesus chooses to continue to appear to them the way he appeared to St. Paul. And the evidence of history is that didn't happen. So you find, for example, Clement of Rome, writing at the end of the apostolic age, talking about how they passed on the office to their successors, the bishops. And that's what history says. So what you can infer from passages like Ephesians 4 and 1 Corinthians 12 is that the early church did have apostles, but there's nothing there saying it's going to continue to have apostles. In the case of Mormons, there's also an additional problem, because it also, like Ephesians 4, talks about how, in addition to apostles, and the same thing could apply to one as Pentecostals, but in Ephesians 4:11, it says that God's gifts were that some should be apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, and some pastors and teachers. Well, okay, notice that, and the same thing is true in the Corinthian correspondence, but notice that puts prophets in the second place. They're inferior to apostles. But in the Mormon church, and I guess this wouldn't apply to one as Pentecostals, but in the Mormon church, the prophet is the head of the Mormon church. And so in their construction, it looks like apostles are superior, prophets are superior to apostles, and that's reversed in the New Testament.
Okay. That makes sense, Manny?
Beautiful.
Beautiful.
Yes, thank you.
All right, very good. Thank you for the call and for the question. Ryan in Midland, Texas, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Welcome back, Ryan. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
All right, Jimmy, I actually have a two-part question for you, if you can get to the first one before the second.
All right. What is the question?
The first one is, okay, when the Pope issued faculties to SSPX priests to hear confessions and to administer marriage when the Year of Mercy began, how can he do that if the SSPX isn't directly under Vatican jurisdiction?
Well, so they are under Vatican jurisdiction, because the Pope has universal jurisdiction in the Church, and the Society of St. Pius X is part of the Church. They used to be in schism, but they're not anymore. And we know that because they had their excommunications lifted. And the only way you can lift an excommunication for schism is if the person is no longer in schism, because schism incurs automatic excommunication. So if you lifted it and they're still in schism, it is automatically reimposed. So we have very good reason for saying that the SSPX is not in schism these days. And they would say they were never in schism, but nevertheless, from a standard Catholic point of view, we've got good evidence they're not in schism, and the Pope has jurisdiction over them. He's got authority over them, and they acknowledge that. They'll say, oh yeah, we're subject to the Pope. They may not obey the Pope in everything. They're running, you know, their own system of chapels that are parallel to parishes, and they are celebrating Mass and so forth in them without permission. And they're doing other things that are irregular or illicit in terms of church law, but they are within the Pope's jurisdiction, as they themselves would acknowledge, and he chose to extend this to them at these two things to them as a sign of goodwill to make it easier for them to minister to people in the relevant circumstances.
Okay, Ryan.
All right. Part two is this. Since attending SSPX masses is permissible in certain circumstances, would the same also apply to attending mass at Society of St. Pius V Church? Because I've heard it said that there's some doubt pertaining to whether or not they are truly seat of a contest.
Okay.
Well, my understanding is they are seat of a contest, and I would need to see evidence that they're not. But my understanding is they not only are not in communion with Pope Francis, and they're not subject to him, but the same is true for multiple preceding pontiffs. And so, if they are not in subjection to the Roman pontiff, then they are in schism. And even if they're using a form of the liturgy that is itself licit, I can't recommend that people attend a chapel that is in full-on schism. That's spiritually unhealthy, and going to any other legitimate mass would be preferable to that.
Ryan, thank you. You brought us to the break. We'll be right back with more Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
We'll be right back with more great answers from Jimmy today on Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily Mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at magnificat.com.
This is Father Romeo Fajardo. Dear friends, if we understand the power of radio, then we can understand that the gospel can be made very real, very convincing, powerful enough to send shockwaves throughout the whole country and indeed the whole world. Catholic radio is necessary in order that the gospel be sent throughout all the world, and most importantly, a convincing witness of Christ's presence here on earth.
The world needs EWTN Catholic Radio, now more than ever.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. July is getting near to its close, and July is the last month to get the $50 off your conference ticket if you're coming to the conference. So if you're thinking about it, check it out at CatholicAnswersConference.com, CatholicAnswersConference.com. Jimmy will be one of the speakers, but there's lots of great speakers coming, and the theme is Learn From Me, the Parables, Sermons, and Conversations of Jesus Christ. It's September 26th through 29th right here in San Diego, CatholicAnswersConference.com. It's Ask Me Anything this hour and next on Catholic Answers Live, and now we go to Gabe in Battleground, Washington, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Gabe, thank you for downloading the app onto your phone. Go ahead with your question. Are you, Gabe?
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Hope you're all doing well.
Well, we're well. It sounds like you're maybe...
Gabe, you need to take us off of speakerphone and talk directly into the phone. Never use speakerphone when you're calling a radio show.
Are you with us, Gabe?
Sure. Give me 1 second here.
Okay. All right. It doesn't even sound like speakerphone. It sounds almost like shortwave radio or something.
My question was, it's kind of a hoping you can help me clarify if I'm on the right track, because I'm new to Catholic teaching. Well, relatively new. I've been watching several debates, including some of Catholic Answers staff and Carrie Machuda versus Dr. James White, and he seems to bring out the same argument when it comes to the biblical canon and the Apocrypha, or Deuterocanon, which is they are not part of what Josephus called made the hands unclean, therefore they are not part of the canon. But, and he also makes the secondary argument that they were, pretty much they were not accepted by the Jews. I had a different question on that. But the question I want to ask, if certain Jews accepted it as part of the canon, this is the second part, that they were not, that these books, that the canon was entrusted to the Jews, wouldn't it make sense that even if not all Jews accepted the Deuterocanon as part of their canon, the fact that they were entrusted, simple fact that certain Jews did receive them, that means that they were entrusted to the Jews. Would that be a legitimate argument or not?
Well, I'm not sure I entirely followed all that, but let me do the best I can with it, and then you tell me if I answered your question. So it seems that you're asking if St. Paul says that in Romans that the oracles of God were entrusted to the Jews, so fair enough. But if there's diversity in the Jewish community regarding what belongs in the canon, then you can't just artificially select one group of Jews and zero in on them and say, therefore, this is the one, when other Jews had other views about what constituted the oracles of God. So, for example, we've got good evidence that the Sadducees did not accept anything beyond the Torah. the first five books of the Bible. And you couldn't therefore say, oh, well, since those are the five books that all Jews agree belong in Scripture, those must be the only books that belong in Scripture. And so you can't just artificially pick one group of Jews. Now, White is indebted to a particular, and I'm not going to call him Dr. White because his doctorate is fake, but he is indebted to a particular scholar named Beckwith, who has an eccentric view these days that the canon of Scripture was defined in the Jewish community some centuries before the time of Christ. And current scholarship, broadly speaking, indicates that is just not true. There were multiple canonical traditions within first century Judaism. The Sadducees had a different canon than the Pharisees. The Pharisees had a different canon than the Essenes. And they had a different canon that was common in Greek-speaking Judaism, which had the Septuagint. And the authors of the New Testament, they adopt the Septuagint. They quote from it 80 to 90% of the time when they quote the Old Testament, and they allude to things that are in the deuterocanonical books. So the situation is much more complex, and frankly, White is drawn on eccentric and fringe scholarship in this regard. Gabe, since you're here in the United States, why don't we see if we can send you a copy of my book, The Bible is a Catholic Book, where I go through the different canonical traditions that were around in the first century. And they had fuzzy, I should also mention, they had fuzzy boundaries. Like even the Pharisee canon, it was a canonical tradition, not a specific canon, because there were books like Sirach and Ezekiel that continued to be debated for quite a while after the first century. So let's see if we can send you that book, and that should help clarify a few additional things.
I get out what you needed, Gabe?
Yeah, pretty much. Actually, I think you were able to follow my very broken reasoning. But
all right.
Because I actually agree with what you were saying. That was kind of where I was going. Because
all right, Gabe.
Sorry.
Oh no, I was just going to say, hang on, and we'll send you the book.
Okay. Oh, actually, you know what? I actually have it as part of my Kindle. I've been reading several books on the subject, which inspired the question. But I appreciate you willing to send it to me. But I think this pretty much makes sense because he keeps reiterating this. Well, for example, with the New Testament argument, even if not all Christians knew about the inspired scriptures, they were still inspired scriptures, regardless of other people's being aware of them.
Okay.
So I kind of had the same reasoning with the Old Testament canon. Even if other people did not recognize those books as canonical, doesn't mean they weren't canonical, which kind of defeats his argument.
Thanks, Gabe. On we go. Luca is in Ontario, California, watching on YouTube. Luca, thank you for your call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, I wanted to know what are some examples of moral relativism being applied and why or in how it fails in government.
In government? Well, I don't normally comment on political matters, but one of the most obvious things to me in terms of certainly recent and current American politics where moral relativism has been applied is on the subject of abortion, where, the argument is, well, you may believe that abortion is wrong, but I don't, and therefore I should be able to have abortion or have my girlfriend or my wife have an abortion. And so that's a form of moral relativism. And it fails. It fails morally because it involves murder. It involves the deliberate killing of an innocent human being, and that cannot be morally justified. They may think it can be morally justified, but they're wrong. It also fails practically because one of the things, there's a saying that demography is destiny. If you don't reproduce yourself, you're gonna have you're ultimately going to collapse as a society. And Americans, regrettably, have been reproducing at less than the replacement rate, which is 2.1 children on average per woman. And we've been able to buy some time by offsetting that with immigration. But the truth is, unless we start reproducing at 2.1 children per woman, we're going to eventually have a societal collapse following a demographic winter. And if given that about a third of pregnancies are aborted, at least that's been the case. It's been around a third over the history of abortion in America since Roe v. Wade. We would be in a positive situation if we were reproducing, if we did not have abortion. We would be demographically positive rather than demographically negative. And so I would cite abortion as an obvious example of moral relativism that fails as a policy.
Luca, thank you. Thanks for the question. I don't know if you have Carlo's book on relativism. Carlo Broussard wrote a book on the new relativism here. It may be slightly tangential to your question, but if you're interested in it, I'd be happy to send it to you. Just hang on, and Edgar will get your address and send it to you. The new relativism. Martin in Connecticut, you are up next. Martin, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi. My question is in regard to the automatic excommunications of apostasy and heresy. Does that mm-hmm. encompass consented to doubts or denials in the mind, which one does not persist in? And if it makes any difference if one lets somebody else know whether or not they had those doubts or denials of the mind?
Okay, so in regard to the first question, what it involves is voluntary doubts or denials. So it's not the same as having a difficulty or feeling, I don't know if this is true. It's willing, I refuse to assent to this, or I refuse to make a decision about it. And then it only applies to things that are dogmas. And what a dogma is, it's a proposition that the church has infallibly defined to be divinely revealed. So it's not even all infallible teachings. It's a subset of infallible teachings, which the church has infallibly defined to be divinely revealed. If one doubts or denies a non-infallible teaching, then there is no excommunication. Even if one doubts or denies an infallible teaching that's not a dogma, there is no excommunication. The excommunication only applies to heresy, which is the willful doubt or denial of a dogma. And so that's where someone says, I just refuse to accept this. Either I outright deny it or I refuse to make up my mind about it. But if you say, I believe what the church teaches, and even though I feel very uncertain here, or I have emotional doubts or something like that, that's not the same thing. It is not a voluntary doubt. But let's suppose a person has a voluntary doubt, either regarding a specific dogma or the whole of Christian dogmas. So one would say, I'm no longer a Christian, which is what apostasy is. It's not apostasy unless you reject the entirety of the Christian faith. Okay, suppose someone has voluntary doubts in that regard, but you never express it to anybody. Does the excommunication still apply? The answer is no. One of the things that the Code of Canon Law provides for is that in order for the excommunication to be triggered, it must be publicly verifiable. Someone else must have heard or known that you were entertaining this willful doubt. And so if you keep it to yourself, there is no excommunication.
Could I have a slight follow-up question?
Go ahead.
Yeah.
If one, say, had those type of things and they didn't let anybody know, but they didn't persist in it in any way, and then later on they said, oh, I had this period in my life where I had that, would that count as like a manifestation of it, or is that just something in the past because they didn't persist in it?
It's if you no longer have such a doubt and you admit to having one in the past, that does not trigger the excommunication. That would be something in the past. You at one point had a doubt and you had this period in your life. And if at that time you had manifested it to someone else, then it could trigger the excommunication. Although even then there's a bunch of exceptions, which we haven't even gone into. But if it's over and done and you later say, I went through this phase, that does not trigger the excommunication. It has to be manifested to someone while the voluntary doubt is still present.
Well, thank you very much for that clarification.
No problem.
Well, thank you, Martin, for the call. Hey, if you if Catholic Answers Live has been positive in your life or someone else's life, and you'd like to share your testimonial of what it meant, we'd like to invite you to visit CatholicAnswersLive.com. Click the red testimonial button. You can leave an audio or video testimonial. They're very helpful to us. They mean a great deal to us, and we'd be grateful if you'd give it try. CatholicAnswersLive.com. Click the red testimonial button and leave your testimonial. We'll continue in just a minute with more Jimmy Akin, Ask Me Anything on Catholic Answers Live. What was the church like in its infancy? In a word, Catholic. And Joe Heschmeyer has the receipts. In his best-selling book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, he gives you the details from the historical records of the first two centuries of Christianity. Right now, get a copy for just $10, plus free shipping if you live in the continental United States. Get more information and order The Early Church Was the Catholic Church at theearlychurchwascatholic.com.
Is Orthodoxy an alternative to the Catholic Church? In a time of uncertainty for many Catholics, Orthodoxy can look like greener pastures. Answering Orthodoxy, the new book from Catholic Answers Press, explains why Catholics who are thinking of leaving need to think twice. There are important reasons to remain in the Catholic Church and convincing answers to Orthodox claims. Order your copy of Answering Orthodoxy today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Is the Catholic faith still a rock amidst the waves of history? Why does it so often seem to be a mess? In his latest book, Confusion in the Kingdom, best-selling author Trent Horn helps you to get to the roots of the present chaos, explaining the destabilizing movements within Catholicism and exposing the harm and scandal progressive Catholicism has caused. Order your copy of Confusion in the Kingdom today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to CASociety315.com and join today.
Matt Sweem here. Tomorrow on the Sunrise Morning Show, we'll celebrate the feast of Saints Joachim and Anne, the grandparents of Jesus. Plus news, weather, sports, and more. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is our guest. All the lines are full, and it's an Ask Me Anything. I want to get to the next call kind of quickly because it's Martin in France. We don't get a lot of calls from France. Martin, are you there with us?
Yes, hello.
Hello, welcome. Thank you for
doing well. Thank you very much for taking my call. So my
Bonjour,
question is
Martin.
To... Pardon?
Bonjour.
Pardon?
Bonjour.
Okay. My question regards, I am a frequent listener of your show, and lately Mr. Akin exposed what I would call a new concept of purgatory defined by the Catechism of 1984 and by Benedict the 16th, allegedly, where it is no longer about expiating temporal punishment, but only about detaching oneself from sin, from sinful attachments, And I really, to me, it's a puzzle how that could be reconciled with former, more authoritative teaching. Let me just quote Indulgentiarum Doctrina from by St. Paul VI. So to me, that sounds very, very authoritative as a formulation, because it states it is a divinely revealed truth. That sounds almost like a definitive statement, that sins bring punishment inflicted by God's sanctity and justice. These must be expiated either on this earth through the sorrows, miseries, and calamities of this life, and above all through death, or else in the life beyond through fire and torments or purifying punishments. Similarly, something that is very dear to me are putative indulgences, that is, indulgences on behalf of souls of the purgatory. I try to get one almost every day for a soul in purgatory. And I simply don't understand how, if purgation depends solely on the purgated soul's own spiritual path of detachment from sin, not on it having a debt in terms of temporal punishment, how, well, what then putative indulgences would be for? I think you would not argue that plenary indulgences override a soul's free will in terms of attachment to sin. And the third argument, it's the Decree on Justification, chapter 14 of the Council of Trent, which states quite, which is, as far as I know, a definitive teaching, as all decrees of the decrees of the Decree on Justification. Hence, it must be taught that the repentance of a Christian after his fall is very different from that at his baptism, and that it includes satisfaction by fasts, alms, prayers, and other devout exercises of the spiritual life for the temporal punishment, as the sacred writing speech is not always a holy remedy that it is done in baptism to those who have grieved the Holy Spirit. So here we have a repentance implied not only as a purely
okay, Martin, process. Martin, I don't have time, I'm afraid, in a radio answer to respond to a dissertation. You've already laid out three arguments. Let me respond to them, okay?
Go ahead, please.
Okay. So in regard to your first argument, doctrinal development is what's responsible here. And what doctrinal development does is it refines things that were already present. So there can be a way of understanding and articulating a teaching in one age, and then the church can continue to reflect on that and offer a more precise formulation. And so in the past, you did have documents like Indulgentiarum Doctrina, and that is a fallible document. It is nothing in it uses the language of infallibility. But it does articulate a truth about purgatory in terms of punishment. And what happened is concurrent with and subsequent with Indulgentiarum Doctrina, which came out in the 1960s, theologians continue, including Joseph Ratzinger, continue to reflect on, okay, so what's the nature of these punishments? And if you read the Catechism of the Catholic Church, it doesn't say that these punishments don't exist. What it says is what they are, what they do, is they free us from disordered desires. And so that's a refinement of an understanding of what they are. It also says that it's completely different than the punishment of the damned, and that it doesn't involve the infliction of pain externally, but flows from the very nature of attachment to sin. And so this is genuinely a refinement. One mistake that a lot of people make when they read past documents, and when a doctrinal development has happened and they compare it to something today, is they try to play, what's the best way to explain it? They kind of play a Trump game. And I don't mean former President Trump. I mean one document trumps another. And so you'll look at some older document and say, well, this is authoritative. And so that allows me to ignore the doctrinal development that has occurred until such time as I see it in a comparable document. And that is not how this works. You have to read all of the documents of the magisterium in continuity with each other. You can't ignore certain documents because they are of lesser gravity. Also, I would argue Catechism of the Catholic Church, that's pretty darn grave. I mean, it's only the second of two worldwide catechisms, and it's the current one, which means it reflects doctrinal development that's happened since the time of, well, let's say the Council of Trent. And I'll come back to Trent in a second. Your second argument was about applying indulgences to someone who's passed on. Well, okay, number one, just so you're aware, the Church has always held that we can only apply indulgences to souls in purgatory by way of prayer, because the Church in purgatory, the Church suffering, is not under the jurisdiction of the Pope. The Pope has authority over the Church militant, and he can exercise the power of the keys over the Church militant, but he can't, by his earthly jurisdiction, directly affect souls in purgatory. So what the Church does in those cases is it prays for the souls in purgatory, and it asks God via someone on earth gaining an indulgence to help that person in purgatory. And that's totally consistent with this articulation of how purgatory works. Pope Benedict even notes that. In Spe Salvi, he talks about how we are not completely separated from the souls in purgatory, and we can intervene. It's not a matter of overriding their free will, because they already want to be purified of their disordered desires. If they died in God's friendship, their will is fixed on good, and those disordered desires are now being purified. And if we obtain an indulgence here on earth, God can apply it to them. So that's that. Those two are not in conflict with each other. The third passage you cite was from one of the chapters in the Council of Trent, and you were quoting from the Decree on Justification. The Decree on Justification, though, is not the Council of Trent's Decree on Purgatory. There's a separate Decree on Purgatory. And it's articulating a truth. Now, the first thing I should mention is the chapters in Trent, they are not infallible. What can be infallible in Trent is the canons. The canons where they say things like, if anyone says X, let him be anathema. Those are infallible. The ecclesiastical penalty of anathema no longer exists, but this was the highest form of discipline in the Church at the time. And so when a canon deals with a doctrinal matter, it does trigger infallibility. With the chapters in Trent, though, they are not infallible. They are authoritative, but they are not infallible. And the chapter that you're quoting basically says that that when a person commits a sin and they're forgiven its eternal debt, there can remain some ongoing consequences and that need to be dealt with. And that's true. All that the Church has done in the Catechism is refine how those consequences are dealt with. It doesn't deny the existence of so-called temporal punishments. It just further clarifies the nature of the temporal punishments. What they do is they remove our disordered desires, and they are different than the suffering of the damned, and that they flow from the nature of sin itself rather than being a kind of punishment inflicted from without.
Martin, I'm very grateful for your call. It is very nice to get a call from France. I got to go to the break now, and that was already a lot. So, but maybe as you come up with follow up questions, if you want to call back, we can have more discussions. But off to the break we go. We'll be right back with more. Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Hello, this is Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione of San Francisco. Keep your dial tuned to Catholic Answers Live.
In Morse code, the sequence SOS is a distress call. It's been said that it stands for Save Our Souls. Well, right now our world is in big trouble, and we're putting out an SOS call for help. Will you answer that call? St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, has hundreds of teams who share the good news with souls who don't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to get involved.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
Hosting Women Made New has helped me deepen my own faith, and I look forward to every weekend having those in-depth discussions with my guests. It's been such a blessing being a part of the EWTN family and carry on the mission that Mother Angelica started.
Women Made New, Saturday noon Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin's our guest. It's Ask Me Anything. Lines continue full. So back to the phones we go. Fabian's in Texas watching on Facebook. Fabian, welcome. You got a question for Jimmy Akin?
Yes, I do. First of all, thank you because he gave me the suggestion to read the catechism, and I found one of my first answers within paragraph 25 of the prologue. So thank you for that.
Yay! Very good.
My question is over the sacrament of marriage, just how and what makes it a sacrament. I don't know that, and I just want to know about it. And if I could find, if you could suggest a resource like you did with the catechism.
If I could suggest a resource that what about the catechism?
Oh, no, no. After your brief summary over the sacrament of marriage, just anything that I could, maybe a resource that I can look into later on. Because right now I'm still on the catechism. I am nowhere near even the first chapter of it. But if you can give me a resource afterwards just to go over the sacrament of marriage later
okay.
on, that's great.
I got it. Okay, so all marriage, both sacramental and natural, is a partnership of the whole of life directed towards the good of the spouses and the procreation and education of offspring. That's what a marriage is. Among baptized people, marriage has been elevated to the dignity of a sacrament. And because it's a sacrament, it communicates God's grace to the recipients so that they are better able to live the Christian life and follow God. And it also is, if it's a consummated sacramental marriage, it also becomes indissoluble. So nothing but death can dissolve it. So that's a basic look at the difference between a sacramental marriage and a natural marriage. For more about marriage, I'll point you right back to the catechism, because you've already got a good, simple, if you have the catechism, you've got a good, simple presentation of all of the basic facts about marriage. There are other works that go into more detail, but as a starting point to understand the sacrament of marriage, read the section on the catechism that covers it. It's in part two of the catechism on celebrating the Christian mystery, because marriage is one of the seven sacraments, so you want to read that section. And it also comes up in the third section of the catechism on the Christian moral life, because thou shalt not commit adultery is one of the Ten Commandments. And so you can look up the sixth commandment and read some more about sexual ethics, including how they interact with marriage.
Okay, Fabian.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much for that. I will be looking forward to getting more into this catechism. Thank you.
Sounds great.
Thank you, Fabian. Jamie's in Boston, Massachusetts, listening on Catholic.com. Hello, Jamie. You got a question for Jimmy?
Hi. How are you guys doing?
Really good. Nice to speak with you again.
You too. It's good to interact again. My question is, so I'm struggling to understand the Eucharist, especially Eucharistic adoration. When I adore the Eucharist, who/what exactly am I adoring? I keep reading about these miracles that are like, it's like his heart tissue is there, but I also hear that it is him fully, like the Eucharist is him entirely. But then I also hear that it's him on the cross. So what exactly? Like, and
all right.
What exactly is going on there?
Okay, Jamie, thank you.
Okay, so Christ is present in the Eucharist, body, blood, soul, and divinity. So the entire Christ is there. Now, the appearances, or they're sometimes called accidents, but the appearances of bread are attached primarily to his body, but his blood, soul, and divinity are also present. And in the same way, the accidents or appearances of wine cover his blood, but his body, soul, and divinity are also present. So you're adoring the entire Christ. In terms of this business about you're adoring Jesus on the cross, well, if that's your intent, then that's what you're doing. But that doesn't reflect what's objectively happening in front of you. Because even though you hear people sometimes advocating this time travel theory of the Eucharist, and believe me, I'm a big fan of time travel. I'm all for time travel. But to be honest, concept of time travel was not present in historic Christian thought prior to the 1900s. I'm sorry, the 1800s. And the early Christians did not understand the Eucharist to be a time warp back to the cross. This is a misunderstanding based on later church teaching. At the Council of Trent, for example, it was taught that the sacrifice of the Mass and the sacrifice of the cross are the same sacrifice in the following sense. And this is where this time travel nonsense gets introduced. Because what happens is people hear sacrifice of the Mass is the same as the sacrifice of the cross, and they forget what follows. They just treat it as if that's an absolute statement, and it's not. What the Council of Trent said was that the sacrifice of the Mass and the sacrifice of the cross are the same sacrifice in that the primary sacrifice in priest is the same, meaning Jesus, and the offering is the same, meaning Jesus, and the purpose is the same, meaning our salvation. But they are different sacrifices in other senses. And one of them, the council notes, is the manner of the sacrifice. Christ was offered in a bloody manner on the cross, so he suffered and died, but he is not being offered in a bloody manner in the Mass. He's not suffering and dying in the Mass. Therefore, no time warp. And this gets aided, this understanding gets exacerbated by the fact that we know in his divine nature, God is outside of time. And that's true. But Jesus's human nature, which is what's involved here, that's inside of time. And the concept of time travel does not apply to Jesus's human nature, at least not unless you get a time machine involved. And there is no time machine here. For further confirmation of this, I would point folks towards the 1968 Credo of the People of God, which was promulgated by St. Paul VI. It's basically kind of an expanded creed. And one of the things it confesses is that the Eucharist is the body and blood of Christ enthroned now in heaven. So what's in front of you in the Eucharist is not AD 33. It's not Jesus in AD 33. It's Jesus right now in heaven. So you're adoring the entire Jesus, and unless you change your intention to cast your intention back to AD 33, you are adoring Jesus as he is right now in heaven and on the altar.
Jamie, I want to come back to you and see if that answer was satisfying for you. Does that work? Do you understand?
That was actually extremely helpful, because my intuition was always just worshiping Jesus in heaven, but then when I started hearing that it was time travel, I was like, I don't know if I believe that. So this is super encouraging. Thanks for your ministry.
Thanks, yeah. Jamie. Boy, you rarely hear Jimmy talk anyone out of time travel, but in this case, it needed to be done.
I'm a big fan of time travel. It's just I'm not going to apply it where the evidence is not in its favor.
It's always pleasant to talk with you, Jamie. Thank you very much for the call. Get to go to Green Bay, Wisconsin. Now Mike is in Green Bay watching on YouTube. Mike, thank you for the call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Gentlemen, long time no listen. How are you?
Very well. Thank you, Mike.
Good, good, good. My question revolves around two separate things. One, Our Lady of Champion, and Lady Adele, who was able to witness the apparition of Mary here, and then Jimmy's current discussion on Mysterious World about the changes the Vatican has implemented in assigning a supernatural cause for things. And I guess I'm wondering how that those new set of rules would apply to determining miracles in the case of someone like Adele, who is up for canonization now.
Okay, so if that's your question, they really don't. The new rules for discernment don't really deal with the kind of miracles that are dealt with in saint canonizations. What the rules are meant for is guiding the dicastery for the doctrine of the faith in helping bishops discern these things. And the dicastery for the doctrine of the faith doesn't really deal with saint canonizations, and therefore it doesn't really deal with the miracles that are used to support those. Those are done by a different dicastery, the dicastery for the causes of saints. And so they have their own procedures for evaluate miracles, and they have it's typically a twofold process. I mean, it's always a twofold process, or basically always. If it's a medical miracle, which it almost always is these days, although historically there were some others, but these days it's basically always a medical miracle. The first thing they do is they have a team of medical specialists known as the Consulta Medica that involves experts on medical matters, and they don't even have to be Catholic. They don't care what your religion is. They care, are you a medical expert? And they ask a group of medical experts, is there any scientific explanation for this healing? And if the Consulta Medica comes back and says, nope, there's no scientific explanation, then they turn it over to a team of theologians to see whether it can be reasonably understood as due to the intercession of a proposed saint. So all that's going on over in the Dicastery for the Causes of Saints. The miracles or other supernatural events besides apparitions that the new norms deal with are principally other miracles that aren't associated with the saint's intercession, like Eucharistic miracles, for example, or statues that weep or things like that. So it's a different process for a different kind of miracle.
Mike, thanks. I'm going to try to get one more question before we have to go. Mark is in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, watching on YouTube. Mark, I'd like to get you an answer from Jimmy, but you got to be quick with the question.
All right. Question about Marian apparitions. You have Our Lady of Akita, Japan, Guadalupe in Mexico, Cabello in Africa. They all look different from each other, each resembling nations that they appear to. How can we have all these different Our Ladies when there is only one Saint Mary? During all these apparitions that have been approved by the church, is it the same lady appearing in all these different events?
Okay.
Thanks, so the basic answer is going to be yeah. Now, one of the things, and this goes back, for example, to Cardinal Prospero Lambertini back in the 1700s, who was later elected Pope Benedict the 14th. He wrote the classic book on this, and he pointed out that there was a controversy at the time about some seers see Jesus crucified with three nails, some see him crucified with four. Which vision should we trust? And he said, it doesn't matter. The point of God giving someone a vision of Jesus on the cross is not to teach us about the number of nails. It's to help us grow closer to Jesus. And in the case of a Marian apparition, it's to help us appreciate Mary and grow closer to Jesus. It's not to teach us about what would she look like if you had a photograph of her. And consequently, the consciousness of the seer will fill in these subsidiary details, like how many nails do they see Jesus crucified with? How does Mary appear? What does she look like? What clothes is she wearing? And it's been observed that she often appears as if she were a member of the local culture. And that's not surprising because it's a way of communicating her closeness to the local culture and her love for the people of the local culture and her maternal care for the people of the local culture.
Mark, thank you for being quick with that question. You can hear the music. That means we have come to the end of this hour, but we've got Jimmy for another hour. We'll continue with Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin right after this on Catholic Answers Live.